This is Edge Cases, a podcast about the grumpier side of software development, mostly, but not always, happily witted, featuring myself and my co-host, the Mark and Mindy of Objective-C. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
This is episode 38. It's Saturday, February 23rd, 2013, and the topic this week is My Adventures with Text Adventure Games.
Okay.
So, it's funny, now when I say the little spiel at the beginning, I'm kind of playing the sound in my, playing the, you know, the background sound in my head as it goes.
Do, 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 do.
Yeah, right. No, that's not it. Okay. So it doesn't sound like we have any follow-up this week, so I guess we can just get started.
I think that's because nobody loves us.
Nobody, well, is that follow-up to talk about that?
No. I think that's just widely known.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. So we don't need to do a topic on that. We can just
right. Yeah. Have we can that. Assume it like air.
like a leaden weight in our, yeah. Okay. So this actually came up as part of a previous episode. This is episode 35. Their Job is to Break It, where I had Peter Hosey as my guest co-host. And I was talking about text adventure games in the context of QA testing. And I said in that episode that there wasn't really much I could talk about in terms of text adventure games as far as relating it to Coco, because there isn't really that much overlap there. But it occurred to me that I might just want to talk about it anyway, because as I say in the intro, we are mostly but not always Apple-related. And since I know, Wolf, you've done an episode or two which is completely unrelated to Apple recently, I figured now is my chance to give that a shot.
Yeah, I think you're immune to lawsuits. You put the disclaimer in every episode.
Yes, I do. Well, that's because I don't want to talk about how little we're loved in the spiel, so I have to say something. So, I say that. Okay, so it's actually kind of funny. I'm gonna go a little bit into... Actually, this is almost entirely an episode where it's about introducing the topic. Because, as I know, we did get, I probably shouldn't mention it, but we did get some feedback recently about, you know, you guys take too long with, you know, introducing something. Can't you just get into it? You know, don't talk about the historical stuff. Well, for me, with text adventure games, it's actually all historical, because this is something from my past, from my mysterious past, and it's not something that I'm engaged in at the moment. So it's all going to be retrospective. But there you go. So in any case, text adventure gaming, or text adventure games... do you know what a text adventure game is? Presumably you do, Wolf.
I have. I've even played one probably five times.
Five times. Okay. All right. So you're an expert. So we could define it by example. And a good example that a lot of people have heard of is Zork. Is that the game that you played?
I believe I did. Is that the one that's kind of like the ripoff of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
No, I don't. That's not how I would describe it. There actually was a Hitchhiker's Guide game.
Oh, actually, maybe I played it on an IBM PC. Like yeah. Original PC.
Right. So the heyday of text adventure games was in the 80s on home computers.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe we'll get back to that. If you played Zork, then you have a good handle on what these things are. If not... I also did mention in episode 35 a little bit of a definition of text adventure games, where I said it was text adventure game was like experiencing an interactive story through terminal.app. And so to maybe expand on that a little more, you take a story and you cut it up so that for each scene, you get a chance to say what the protagonist is supposed to do next using text commands. And text commands, in the same way that you would use commands on the terminal, go west, take sword, attack troll, stuff like that. So this is as I said, this is the history of it is they've been around since the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. People were writing these games on mainframes back in the day, and then they ported them to home computers in the 80s. And home computers did not have a lot of memory or a lot of graphical capability. So that was one reason why they were text then, and why they had the typing then to do things. In let's see. And so that's to break up the phrase a little bit. You might think that they're called adventure games because you have adventures in them, right? You gather treasure, solving a mystery, saving the world. But that would be wrong. In fact, adventure comes from the very first text adventure game, which was called Adventure, and which was later renamed Colossal Cave. And it was written by, actually, you know what? You look it up. I'm not going to go through all of the intro because we only have 40 minutes. And it's actually really interesting. And if you search on Colossal Cave, you'll find out a lot more information about it. So that's where adventure comes from. They're games because by tradition, there are puzzles to solve in it, and you can win by solving the puzzles or by gathering the treasure or whatever. There's usually a point system. Actually, not usually. In a lot of the early games, there was a point system. Colossal Cave had a point system. I believe Zork had a point system as well. So, you know, you do all the things that get you points and then you win. And they're text, because obviously you're typing in a command line. Now, there were eventually graphical adventure games. And this was when CD-ROM drives got to be popular. So you've probably heard of Myst, most of you, M-Y-S-T. That was extremely popular. And I think they needed CD-ROM drives to be around because you needed more storage space for the graphics and the sounds in order to get kind of an immersive experience. Now, there may have been games before then. I don't remember exactly. But those are the ones that I played. And, okay, so text versus graphical. That's why you specify text for these kind of games. And the reason why, in my experience, I'm going to be talking about text games is because they're the thing that you can make as a single developer. Once you start to get into graphical games, you need artists, you need sound people, you need all sorts of things to create the game, to finish the game, to publish it. But text adventure games, you can just make as a single developer on your own without any expensive tools or anything like that. And so that's what I did, probably over 10 years ago now. And that's the scene that I got involved in. There's actually a community of text adventure gaming enthusiasts, and that's what they're interested in, and that's what they focus on. So we're talking a little bit about, you know, when these games came out commercially. There was a company called Infocom that put out quite a few of them. Sierra Online put out some graphical ones. But then all of that kind of eventually went away. Infocom got bought by Activision. And so there wasn't a way you could make money off of it anymore. But there were still people who said, well, I want to play these games and I want to write these games. So, and fairly small group, but, you know, they exist. And so they reverse engineered the format of Zork, the other Infocom format, and they made their own tools to create games based on that. And from that came the text adventure game specific programming language called Inform. And there were also other languages as well, Adrift, TADS, probably a couple others. I wrote my games in TADS. Now to go, let's see, a little bit more detail on this. The games that you write in these non-commercial languages that were created are generally not executables. You don't create a Windows application. You don't create a Mac application. Instead, you create a data file. And so you need an application to run them, and they're called interpreters. And this probably sounds familiar to most people who work with Java or anything like that. So, you know, you get to compile the source code down to, you know, bytecode that can be run on the virtual machine. And of course, you know, Java, for example, C Sharp, but of course, virtual machines have existed long before those languages existed. And that's kind of where all the ideas came from. And I always liked, in addition to being able to write these games without having to put out a lot of money to do it, I also liked the fact that this architecture also allowed these games that you're writing to outlast the existing platforms that they were written during. So, for example, the games that I wrote were, let's see, during OS 9, during Classic, and during the PowerPC days of OS 10, very early days of OS 10. Actually, I'm not even sure OS 10 had officially come out by the time I put out my second game. But in any case, if I had written games that were then, you know, compiled to PowerPC bytecode, written against these APIs of the OS, I would not be able to play them anymore. Whereas instead, because they're just these files and people have updated the interpreters since then, you can still play them today. And I was actually just playing the first of my games an hour ago. And so, you know, like Windows has not gone away. The Mac has not gone away, but the Mac has gone through a lot of changes. And there were other platforms back in those days, you know, Amiga, Acorn, early Windows. And, you know, those are all gone. And there are also new platforms now that you can play my games on or other people's games on that didn't exist then. So Android or iOS, for example, there are ways to do that now as well. And so that's one good thing about the scene. Now, the commercial scene, these Zork games, there's actually a, I might put a link in there, won't do us much good. There's actually a link from Infocom, because Infocom is, the assets of Infocom are still being actively maintained by their company that owns them now. It might still be Activision. Did Activision rename itself Atari? Was that what happened? I don't know. But in any case, there was actually a link to, like in maybe 10 years ago, to, oh, hey, download Zork for free. And it was a Windows game and it was a Mac game. And those links are still active because the Mac game is a classic game. You can't play it. So that's, there you go. So let's see. And I was also involved with some of the tools at the time. You know, we needed a compiler on the Mac to compile these games down to their bytecode, an interpreter. And I was involved in that for a little while, but I never actually shipped anything, unfortunately. Story of my life. So if you talk with people in the scene, they'll be like, oh yeah, that guy, he never shipped anything. Well, but I shipped a couple of games. So, and we'll get to that in a bit. But for where to go for this community, there's a couple of links I'm going to talk about, and they'll also be in the show notes. If you want to download the games or the interpreters or the compilers, you can go to ifarchive.org, all one word, ifarchive. There's also a yearly competition, and it's ifcomp.org. And there's also a different awards organization that does things once a year. And they do, it's called the Zizzy Awards, XYZZY, which is a spell name in Zork, I believe. So xyzzyawards.org, all one word. And a couple others that'll be in the show notes. Now, you might have noticed in these URLs that I've been putting out here, they use IF. And so what does that stand for? Well, in this scene, in this community, they've taken to not calling them text adventure games. Instead, they call them, Wolf, do you know?
Interactive fiction, but only because I have the Google page up in front of me.
Right. So, you know, and that's what they call them. That's the tradition. So, you know, I go along with it. But I do have to say, when I was writing down what I was going to say during this talk, it has always struck me as a little ill-fitting to call them that. If not, maybe a bit pretentious. Because most of these things, they are still games. There are actually some IF works which are more sort of exploratory artistic works, which are trying to, you know, create a mood or tell a different kind of story or that sort of thing. So they exist, and a lot of them are, you know, good stuff. But at least from when I was doing this, you know, 90, 95% of the games, the works were games, were traditional games. So I would still tend to call them text adventure games myself. I'm going to use that terminology here. But you'll know that if you do want to get into the scene yourself, and that's one of the reasons why I'm having a podcast about it, because if this does pique your interest, you can go to the community. It's a fairly small community. It's worldwide. If it wasn't for the internet, these people would never have found each other, you know, because having two or three people interested in this in the same place is actually quite unusual. But you know, the internet made it possible for this very niche market to come together. And also keep in mind, you know, when I say, you know, my adventures in text adventure games, this is just going to be my experience. I've done a little bit of research about this, but I haven't tried to fact check everything. If you talk to a different person, they might have a different take on all this as well. Okay, so let's see. I'm going to talk about games a little bit, talk about programming interactive fiction a little bit. Now, I was going to save this for later, but why don't I throw it in now? I'm actually not going to tell you what my games are. I'm going to have two games. They're actually award-winning games. I talked about XYZY in the competition. I did win awards for both of them, so you can call me an award-winning game author if you want. I'm sure I'll put that into the, you know, the intro. but there's a lot of tradition in how these games work a lot of the time. There are a lot of customs, things that are customary in these games. And so my games are not really a way for you to introduce yourself to the field. Instead, I would recommend that you go to brasslantern.org, all in word, /beginners, and beginners with an S, because that sort of introduces you to the scene, introduces you to what adventure games are, and gives you some games to go play to get used to it. My games tend to be very kind of insidery. They tend to be rather difficult, and so I would not recommend them as well. Now you can go find them yourself if you want. They're not hidden; they're on the internet. But I would urge you that if you're saying, well, hey, you know, this guy has a podcast that I like, so I'll go play his game. Please don't. which follows on our theme of, you know, please don't listen to our early episodes. Please don't play my games. You know,
I wonder why people don't love us.
Yeah, right. It's apparently because we don't love ourselves. But if you do, if you are an expert, if you played a lot of these games and you just haven't heard of my games, by all means, go ahead and play them. If you get into the scene and play some of these beginner games and say, well, I really like this, then by all means, go play my games. The games I wrote back in the day were written in TADS, which is the Text Adventure Development System. It is one of these IF-specific programming languages. It is not the most popular. The most popular one is Inform, and we may talk about that in a little bit. Now, TADS, like all these other languages, they're both a language and a library. And like just about anything, you know, Objective-C is a language and a library. Java is a language and a library. And of course you do that because it makes sense, because you want to make things easier for the kinds of things you think people are going to do. And in this case, of course, the thing that you're going to be doing is writing a game. So there's default support for things like directions, north, south, east, and west, common verbs, taking things. There's an inventory system. You say, well, this object, I'm holding this object now. And there's a bunch of default verbs: take, inventory, kick, punch, say, a whole bunch of others. There's a whole bunch of them. Now, for many of these verbs in these libraries, what they do is the library defines a standard response. So one of the most famous, I think, is from Inform, where if you try like kick or hit anything, it'll say violence isn't the answer to this one, which is neat, right? So for a player, this tells them that, you know, don't keep trying this. Don't keep trying that approach to things. Don't try to solve the puzzle by doing that. But for the aficionado, what this says is, well, the author didn't even change the default from the, the library, right? Now, there's a certain amount of guess the verb in virtually every game that I've ever played. And I think of it as being kind of part of the custom of the thing, that, you know, you get to this command line and there's nothing there. Like, you, in theory, you could type in anything in the world, and the games, kind of the implicit promise of these games is that, well, we'll handle it. But they won't handle it, of course, because the parser is quite simple. It's not trying to use AI. It's not trying to use heuristics, as far as I know, at least from the systems when I was using them. It's a very literal, very specific parser. Okay, if this do this, if this do this, if this do this. You know, if we find something we recognize as a verb, well, that's what we're going to assume it is, and then we're going to look for a direct object. And it can be very frustrating for people used to colloquial English, because they won't get a handle on it. So the very first barrier of these kind of games is just figure out how to talk to a computer in a way it will understand. It's actually very Siri-like, really. I mean, Siri is really text adventure games all over again.
You know, I was just considering that. I mean, I think that was the Syracuse argument against Siri, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, you would hope that, you know, all of this brain power people have thrown at computers for all these years, that they would, you know, you'd be able to do better than that. But you can't. But you can't yet, anyway. AI research just doesn't seem to have had the effects that people would want it to have. And it's almost like, for me as a programmer, it's better when it's simple. Because then you don't have to say, well, it's just magic. I'm just going to try anything forever and then just going to be very, very frustrated forever because I can't ever figure it out. at least if it's very simple, you know, well, if I follow the rules, I'll get something out of it, even if it's a very limited thing. And if you, you know, the difference between these kind of games and like Choose Your Own Adventure is entirely that. Like in one case, you get the illusion of being able to do anything. And in one case, you know, get a very, okay, you can only do one of these four things. But they're both very limited state machines. So really, I think text adventure games are, they're trying to live on, they're trying to take the most maximum advantage of being an illusion, of giving you this wider space in your mind than it can really literally provide to you. And actually, that's another reason why people like text adventure games, is because you can, you know, it gets your imagination going in a way that very other, there, you know, a lot of bang for your buck for getting something very imaginative going. You know, I could write a game that's a complete, you know, blockbuster, you know, explosions, spaceship battles, whatever, aliens, you know, and I'm still, you know, paying for the electricity for my computer, and that's it, to make that happen. Okay, so where was I? Okay, so vocabulary is quite limited. They don't try to pack the whole Oxford English Dictionary into these games. See, and this is the difference. Like, okay, you're saying what's possible for computers versus what's possible for these games. And these games, you know, written by, you know, half a dozen games, the system, you know, written by at most like a half a dozen people in their spare time. And actually, even, you know, this is another thing, like the half a dozen people in their spare time can actually do about as well as, you know, a big team that you pay for. And that's true. So it's all down to the limitations of computers. Like nobody could do that much better than these people could. But on the other hand, they also, you know, they can't put every verb in there. And okay, so where was I here? Sorry here. Let me just give me a second here. Okay. So all of this, you know, all this kind of, well, and one thing that came up at one point during my career doing this was the idea of what happened? This idea that you might be able to take text adventure games and kind of have a rejuvenation of them. So, for example, if you introduced like a well polished, a well written game when the iPad first came out, you know, when there weren't that many other games for it, that you could make a splash. You could make people want to play these games because there wouldn't be that many other options, and it's a new computer. Well. Try new things, that sort of thing. And this is something where, I guess, you know, to a certain degree, my inherent skepticism got the better of me. Because what I think is this environment where it's meant to be a challenge. It's meant to make you scratch your head a little bit. Is probably not something that most people ever really want to do. So if you throw this environment at someone on an iPad, when they just got their iPad, they want to try a new game, try a new experience, and you know you start typing things and nothing works because you haven't guessed the right thing yet. You haven't guessed how to do it yet. Most people, I think, are going to be frustrated at that, and they're not going to want to play it. And so what I was kind of thinking was, well, the only way you could make IF something that would have mass appeal again is probably to turn it into something that's not IF anymore. You know, to basically make it more like a choose-your-own-adventure, where instead of just having a bajillion verbs that you could choose, and you have to keep picking them and typing them until the one works, you have to give them basically like in-game hints, like almost all the way through, like not just in case you have any trouble, but from the very beginning. You just have to make it, you know, just much less of a puzzle in order to make it work. And I think that would go against what the scene is really about at this point. But in any case, back to coding. Okay, so I was actually looking through the code for my first game before the podcast. And what's interesting is that code, it's written in TADS, doesn't look all that different from the object-oriented C-based language code of any other thing we tend to work on these days. So, you know, Objective-C code, Java code, it really looks pretty similar in a lot of ways. There are objects, there are properties on the objects, there are methods on the object. stuff like that. But what's different here is the objects are actual objects. You know, if you're not making like a window manager or a view manager, you're making a book. That's your object. You know, so that's both your object, your language object and your actual object. A lamp, a hat, and you know, there's inheritance like there is in virtually all other languages, and the library will handle some of the built-in functionality. So you could have a wearable object that the library will have default functionality for. Okay, now you're wearing it. Default functionality for like light sources. Okay, now this object is emitting light, and then that means that for a particular location that you're in, now you can see the regular description, whereas if the light source is off and there are no other light sources, now you see the darkness description. You know, you'll be eaten by a Gru, that one that everybody always makes jokes about. So there are two pieces to any object. The state, like any object that you would work on in a Coco program. So, for example, let's say you've got a gun and, you know, you're shooting it, so your object will want to keep track of its how many bullets are left, for example. Or let's say you have a piece of paper that can turn into that you know origami. And so it needs to keep the state of whether it's an actual piece of paper or whether you fold it into a little crane, for example. And so you have to keep track of that. Have the state in your object and know what's going to happen with it. So there are also verbs. Most of the interaction with your object is going to be with the user doing something to it. Take book, read book, for example. So, you know, read is a default verb for most of these libraries. But maybe by default it says, you know, you see nothing special. So if you want your book to do something else, you want to have it, you know, tell the user the magic spell or whatever, then you've got to override that and have its own result. And of course, that's the way you change state as well. And, you know, for example, if you want to have doing a particular object, like taking a book or reading a book, increases your score, you have to put that logic in the method as well. Now, overall, I would say that games, text adventure games, are much less complex than, say, a medium-sized iOS or Mac app. But what's killer is that the state that does exist, the logic that does exist, has to be kept consistent and seamless for the player. And so let's say you have 30 objects and 40 locations and 50 verbs. You've got to handle every combination of all of those things at any point in the game. So let's say for one game, you know, there's a portion of it where it's at night when you're, you know, you're creeping around and you're, I don't know, escaping ghosts or whatever. And then there's the portion the next morning. Well, those, you know, suddenly you've doubled your state because you got to make sure that everything that you could try has the right effect at night and then during the day. And I found when I was writing these games that the best approach is to limit things. Now, as I said, there could be default things that the verbs do. But also you want to, and so that's really what you want to do is you want to keep as many of those defaults as possible. In the same way that you would do for maintaining, when you're maintaining a regular program. So for example, you want to keep the methods of your class as many of them private as possible, so that nobody else can use them. Nobody else can invoke them, can change the state. Well, yes, in the same way for your objects in your text adventure game, you want to keep as many at the default value as possible, many of them that do nothing as possible. So for example, let's say you have a kazoo that in a particular room or in a particular set of circumstances, you know, playing it makes something good happen. Well, then for every other place in your house or whatever, the locations in your game, you've got to be able to handle play a kazoo. Now, so you might have a default response to that. Like, let's say, this doesn't seem the right place to play that. Okay, you know, fine. We're done. I just did it. Now I only have to override that for the case of the one room where things really happen. Well, but maybe that's not right. Maybe, you know, there are places, you know, maybe there's maybe you're in a school and there's a band practice room. And, you know, not playing a kazoo there would be stupid to say that, you know, you're not the right place to play this. Of course, you'd want to play a kazoo, but whatever. And so maybe you want to change that to, well, you toot a few bars and nothing happens. So what's interesting to me, what's always been interesting to me, is that it's a combination of getting the logic straight so that illogical things don't happen, and also getting the atmosphere straight, getting the ambiance straight. Because what might sound logical might still not make a good game if things don't fit in well, if things don't flow the way you would want them to in an experience, in an interactive fiction experience. So it combines, in my mind, it combines, you know, programming logic with writing. And that's really what I like about text adventure games. That's why I got into them. That's why I wrote them, is because I like writing things. I like writing not just programs, but I like writing text. I like writing fiction, nonfiction. And I want to be able to make works like that compelling and interesting. Now, one other side of this is that when you do stop the narrative for a puzzle, you have to make sure the narrative can handle being stopped and can handle the person, you know, typing in the same verb 200 times because they're frustrated and they don't know what to do next. So, for example, you might have things in your game which say, well, give a random response to this, a random response that tells you that nothing's really going to happen. So, you know, if you, you know, play kazoo and there are birds outside, and you know, you're in a garden or whatever, well, maybe some of the birds will fly away scared, or some birds will, you know, will sing with it or whatever. So you may give a couple of responses to give sort of ambiance to the game, to give sort of an atmosphere. But then, you know, if you only have like five responses, well, then maybe that's not enough. Maybe you decide that that's not worth it, because if they just keep doing that, well, they're going to get the same responses. It can be obvious that it's mechanical. And there isn't really that many ways you can get around that. In the same way that the parsing is limited, you know, your chance to give 3,000 responses to something is also pretty limited, because you just can't write that many things that will really work. So that's really where the limits come in. And that's also where I think, you know, limiting it to be sort of, instead of this experimental artistic endeavor, you know, like calling it a game is actually kind of, for me, it's a nice way of kind of deflating the stakes of it. Like, you're not trying to make a strange, amazing experience. You're writing a game, and you want the game to be enjoyable. And that was enough of a goal for me. But one thing that I didn't like, the thing that didn't work for me in the end, was, in fact, the puzzles. So as I said, I like sort of joining together writing and programming, logic and prose. But what you need in order to be both an author of these games and a player of these games is to be a programmer and a puzzler. You need to be Sherlock Holmes. And what I found after I played a lot of these games was that most of the puzzles in these games, in most of the games, were beyond me. I would get frustrated if I tried to solve them. And this also, there are actually quite a few games, I mean, maybe that, you know, again, this is my experience 10 years ago, maybe it's all changed now, but there were a lot of games that were like a puzzle hunt, like some very famous games in this genre, where basically there were hundreds of locations, and you could, you know, get objects from all of these different places and information from all these different places, and you had to use them in all of these other different places. And it was kind of meant to sort of tickle your brain like that, to make you think, to make you puzzle through this stuff. And I would just get stuck. And the trouble is, when there's like 10 different places you can go, or 100 different places you can go, is you get stuck in 100 different places, and you're not quite sure how far you've reached in any one place. Well, have I done everything I can do here? Well, if I'm stuck in these five other places, well, maybe I haven't done everything I can do. And I just, my mind didn't work like that. I got very frustrated. Now, there are hints and walkthroughs to make your way through these games. But because so much of the experience is, you know, powering your way through these puzzles, not doing that really felt like cheating. Felt like I wasn't really playing the game. Wasn't really experiencing it the way that it should have been experienced. And I will say that for me, at least, I never had a game where if I started to use the walkthrough, let's say I used it once, I could then go back and then just keep solving the rest of the puzzles myself. Now, once I was using the walkthrough, I was kind of stuck using the walkthrough from then on, because the momentum had really broken. And the worst part of this is that I was actually part of the problem. Because even the games that I wrote, like when I go back to them, they're too hard. They were requiring too much in the way of guess the verb, of being too clever. And I'm sure they frustrated people when they tried to play it. Now, at least one of the games, the one that I played today, I put in a hint system, kind of in one of the later versions, as kind of a, oh, okay, fine, these are too hard. You know, we'll basically give you, you know, and the hints were progressive. And that's, you know, that's a good thing about these games. When you have progressive hints, you can say, well, here's a little teaser. Okay, now here's a little bit more information. Now here's a little bit more. Here's a little bit more. And, you know, that does help. But oftentimes when I think back, you know what? Progressive disclosure like that is just not enough. Because most of the time, okay, if I have no clue about this game, the first three gentle hints, they're not going to be enough. They're not going to tell me what I need to know. So I'm just going to keep going until I get the solution. And I actually found myself doing that with my game. So that tells you something. And so yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad that, and you know, I'm not bragging that my games were hard either. Like I'm saying, you know, if I could have done it over, I wouldn't have made them like that. I probably would have made them more beginner friendly, made them less insidery baseball. Like there's aspects of these games where I was trying to be clever within the conventions. And again, that's one reason why I don't want to encourage you all to go play them right now. You know, I was kind of being a smartass when I wrote these games, which, you know, for people listening to this podcast will not be a big surprise, me being a smartass. So, but that's pretty much it. You have any thoughts there, Wolf?
Yeah, so I took some notes here while you're talking. The one thing about text adventure games or interactive fiction, whichever you want to go with, is that it strikes me as very programmery, kind of the programmer mindset. And I wrote down a couple of things that you said here. It's the guess how to do it type aspect. It's like so often as programmers, we have this thing we want to do, you know, kind of this quest and this goal to achieve, and it's up to us to figure out how to do it. And I tend to be kind of annoyed at having to figure out how to do things. So I think this is, but you know, some people just love it, and I think it's pretty common among programmers. Another thing is the in mind visualization of being fed a textual description of something, or kind of, you know what's going on, and you can kind of vision an object graph in your mind, which is, so, you know, you obviously usually start in a room or something, and then you navigate around with the go west, go east type stuff. And as you explore, you build this map in your mind. And Simon, I'm sure if you're actually good at this, maybe even on paper, but with programming, it's often like I envision data structures and like flows in my brain. And so that's a pretty one-to-one correspondence there. And then, of course, the last part, which you just mentioned, which is the teasers, which it strikes me as just like just in using the command line in general. It's like you're trying this command, and you know, maybe you're trying to use the find command. And the first thing you do is like you type find, and that doesn't work. And I go, okay, find dash dash help. And you try and get the next teaser. And maybe that's good enough. Maybe it isn't. And then you just kind of give up and you go to the man page. And, you know, of course, those aren't actually written to be useful. So it's always puzzles on top of puzzles.
Well, right. And then you go to Stack Overflow. Right. So, yes.
Right. Yes. You just should have gone there in the first place.
Right. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
So it strikes me that actually once you get stuck playing these games is more like debugging than like programming.
Yeah. And then the other thing I'd like is that when you say like logic might not make a good game, and I totally see that. And the analogy that popped in my mind when you mentioned that was at C4, Robert Anderson talked about making icons. And one of the things, I think he used a program called Cinema 4D, where which is a 3D program, and where you kind of like, you have these, especially Mac OS X icons tend to be very photorealistic, very large. And so it's like you basically kind of need this very detailed 3D model, like the type of stuff like Pixar does. But the thing is that that's never enough, because the next step in that is like you'd build your 3D model, and then he like bring it to Illustrator or Photoshop or what have you. And to me, that's because it didn't look good enough. And that's when you have to like do some more texture work and maybe some backgrounder work or what have you. And that struck me as very much the same type of thing about logic, is that like human beings in general seem to be like, there's the logic thing. I mean, obviously the 3D model is perfect, right? It's like you're doing your rendering on it. It's perfectly 3D and all that, but it just doesn't look quite right, or it's not quite rich enough. So that's when you have to add like the human little smudge on it that adds the thing that we need that goes beyond perfection, or at least diminishes the perfection.
Right. And this, for me, it struck me, I mean, this is, anytime you're telling a story, anytime you're performing, I mean, you're part of the performance industry. You know, you're part of, you're not trying to convey information. You're trying to convey an experience, and that is show business, right? And yeah, you never want to try to give, you know, the real world experience in show business. You want to convey a sharpened, a heightened way of looking at things that satisfy people, that gives them something that they can remember. You know, it's the same thing with like Uncanny Valley, not really actually the same thing at all, but I'm going to mention it anyway, because it does strike me as that sort of thing. Like you do need to massage things to make them something that the human brain will accept, and that, or at least the human brain in our particular culture at this particular time will accept as being something that is entertaining. And yeah, you have to work on that. And again, that's why I think it's so difficult to make a game work, because you're trying to make a seamless experience when there are so many different variables involved, and being able to massage that as well as is possible is what makes you a good game programmer. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Yeah, that does it for me.
Okay. So let's see. So it's just, you know, kind of in closing, I just want to say, you know, I do think this is a good place for people who are, you know, who really like puzzles and kind of like sort of a nerdish kind of, you know, environment. Like the people that I know in this community, they're the nicest people you could ask for. And it's good because it's such a small scene, you know, you can talk to kind of like, you know, the award-winning authors, you know, they're right there for you to talk to, for you to get involved in. So again, if this strikes as something that you would like, I definitely recommend you trying out some of these links and getting involved. And you know, don't be intimidated or anything, because it's a good place to be. Okay. So let's bring up the end thing here. Let me see. Please visit our website, edgecasesshow.com, all one word, for show notes, a link to our podcast on iTunes, and more. And you can find us individually on Twitter, me, A. Pontius, APONTIOUS, and also on app.net, which has been getting a little bit more traffic now that I've said in my last podcast that I was kind of going to, you know, not listen to it anymore.
I believe you called it a wasteland.
I believe I did. And Wolf, his last name, Wrench, that's the word rent, R-E-N-T, plus Z, plus S-C-H. We'll see you next time.